Somalia is in a state of flux. There is a new president, but corruption remains endemic. There are new hotels, restaurants, businesses springing up in Mogadishu, yet there is also famine in the countryside. There is an international peacekeeping force, yet the threat of Al-Shabaab remains very real. So which way is Somalia heading? And are the various other nations involved, from the UK and the US to Turkey and the UAE, a help or a hindrance? This is The Foreign Desk.
Al-Shabaab is conscripting little children all across southern Somalia. When the children reach 15, they just take them to the battlefield without consulting their parents.
If my administration fails, we hope you hold us to account. We promise to do the same. Only in that spirit we can lift Somalia to a new height.
It feels so familiar, and the last time this happened, 5 years ago, it was actually a disappointment.
We're looking at yet another famine. Shabaab is still there. We have another internationally backed government which is trying to do things differently.
There are Al-Shabaab sympathisers right inside the heart of the administrations. And I think it's wrong to think of the goodies and the baddies, because actually it's incredibly blurred. And you will get people who are sort of Al-Shabaab by night and a government soldier by the day.
Hello and welcome to The Foreign Desk. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Somalia is not the only country in the Horn of Africa in the midst of a crisis. Today's programme is the first of three episodes looking in detail at the region. Next week we'll be discussing Ethiopia, the week after Kenya. It's a region that the West has long seen through the twin lenses of terrorism and poverty. And there's an argument, which we'll explore, that these stances have done more harm than good. Not that there is a straightforward answer to any of the problems those countries throw up, but we'll talk about the challenges and at least explore some of the other options. So today, Somalia. In a moment, we'll hear from my guests Mary Harper and Mohamed Mubarak. But first, Monocle's Nairobi correspondent Tristan McConnell, who's covered the Horn of Africa for the past decade, explains more about Somalia's recent history.
So the recent history of Somalia really begins in about 1991, when we saw the collapse of the last centralised government, which was run by a military dictator called Siad Barre. That triggered a couple of decades of clan warfare and civil war that really defined Somalia and gave it its reputation as the world's premier failed state. During that time, there was a whole host of disasters befell the country, including a famine in 1992 and 93, which in turn led to an incident very famous now known as Black Hawk Down, where American soldiers were killed on the streets of Mogadishu. And that really led itself to a withdrawal by the US from involvement in crises across the continent. Following the withdrawal of the US and the UN, we had another 10, 15 years of clan warfare, which only really ended when an Islamic group called the Islamic Courts Union took over in 2006. And that was really just a few months of peace for the first time in Somalia's modern history. But that ended very abruptly when the US backed Ethiopia to invade Somalia and get rid of this Islamic group, which through the lens of the war on terror was seen as a threat, a terrorist threat to the region. And that in turn led to yet more unforeseen consequences, which was the emergence of a group called the Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group fighting to overthrow the internationally backed government in Mogadishu. And they've been doing that for the last 10 years now. As a result of that continuing conflict, there was a famine in 2011 that killed a couple of 100,000 people. And now in 2017, we're looking at yet another famine. Shabaab is still there. We have another internationally backed government which is trying to do things differently.
That was Monocle's Nairobi correspondent Tristan McConnell. I'm joined now by Mary Harper and Mohamed Mubarak. Mary Harper is Africa editor at the BBC World Service and the author of Getting Somalia Wrong, Faith, War and Hope in a Shattered State. Mohamed Mubarak is a political and security analyst and the founder of anti-corruption NGO Makati, and he joins us on the line from Mogadishu. Mary and Mohamed, thank you both very much for joining us today. Mary, if I can begin with you, depending on what story you read, Somalia is either on the up, hotels opening in Mogadishu, a new president elected, or it is still stuck in the mire, the threat of Al-Shabaab, endemic corruption, famine, and let's face it, the president wasn't really elected, he was more selected. Which story is more accurate?
I'm going to give you the answer you probably don't want to hear, which is a bit of both. It does feel very much like déjà vu. In 2012, there was a new president, a sense of euphoria. There was a sort of sense of almost post-election bliss descended on Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab had recently been booted out from many parts of the city. And it almost feels like this time with the selection of another president, Mr. Farmajo, sort of has that same sense of a feeling that, oh, now we are on the cusp of some great hope for Somalia. But it feels so familiar. And the last time this happened, 5 years ago, it was actually a disappointment. And if you look at the situation on the ground in Mogadishu now, I've just spent quite a lot of time in Somalia. And I would say that Mogadishu now, compared to Mogadishu in 2012, is really not very different in terms of security. In fact, in some ways, it's worse. There are more villas, more hotels, more malls. It's looking pretty fancy. But at the same time, you do have highly unpredictable situation when it comes to security.
Mohamed Mubarak, do you share that view that while there may be more money in the city, there are more problems for the residents?
Yes, in a sense, the general argument made by Mary is correct in that things look prettier, but security is still as bad as in 2012, if not worse. Actually, it is worse. In 2012, all of 2012, we didn't have as much suicide bombings as we had in the first 3 months of this year. So we have to think about the reasons why this is the case. It's mainly because of the lack of investment, lack of proper utilization of the investment for security. Billions have been spent by Somalia and its partners, and all that money has gone to waste because of mismanagement and corruption. It's not lack of investment, it's just that the investment was not managed appropriately.
Mohamed, with your NGO, you work very heavily on issues of corruption. Do you feel that the problem of corruption has got worse in recent years?
It's not so bad. It was still bad. In 2012 and 13 and 14, it was the same levels. And it spiked tremendously in 2015 and 16, and mainly because of the elections. The incumbent at that time was seeking to get re-elected. He knew what he should do, and he was ready to lay the groundwork for his victory. He was ready to buy the MPs. And in the final round, if he could not buy them in the initial stages by buying the elders and the voters. So he spent tens of millions of dollars. In the last night alone, he spent $12.5 million, according to people who were present, and he gave 250 MPs and $50,000 each. So all that money is money that was stolen from and that could have been used to improve Mogadishu's security. To be honest, I don't think it requires a lot. And just paying the security forces could change so much. For about a year, most of the security forces have not been paid. So if the person who's supposed to be protecting us does not get payment, how will they protect anybody? They will be easily be bought, or at least, in the very least, they will not do their job.
Mary Harper, this is the problem, isn't it? There's a very simple story that we're often told by UK government officials, by American government officials when they can be bothered to talk to us about Somalia, by the European Union as well, that there are essentially goodish guys and bad guys, and we've got to back the goodish guys, that there is a process, that there is a president, there's a sort of election now, and these people are doing their best. Many of them have lived overseas, they're going back to do their best. And as Mohamed has just pointed out there, many of these people that are being propped up and supported by the West are crooks.
And what is sort of so depressing in some ways about Somalia, and actually now the self-declared Republic of Somaliland as well, there are kind of jokes that go around when they say, oh, so we've got to hunt down Al-Shabaab. The first place we should go is to the cabinets of those two territories, because there are Al-Shabaab sympathisers right inside the heart of the administrations. And I think it's wrong to think of the goodies and the baddies, because actually it's incredibly blurred. And you will get people who are sort of Al-Shabaab by night and a government soldier by the day. I actually spent some time in the town of Baidoa, which is completely surrounded by Al-Shabaab, but it's really quite well secured. It's one of these new states that have been formed, and it's got a ring of Ethiopian troops around it. And then inside the town itself, it has a militia called the Darwish, who are effective at hunting down Al-Shabaab. And I spoke to lots of people who have just left Al-Shabaab, and you just get the feeling that you have got to stop thinking of this as a sort of black and white issue. It's just grey. The whole thing is grey. You know, money is what buys you support. And in the situation in Baidoa, where there's a terrible, terrible drought in that region, it's what was known as the Triangle of Death in 1991, because so many people died in a famine. I met lots and lots of women and children and old men who'd come to the town to try to get some kind of assistance because they'd lost all their livestock, and they were so ill. They were starving to death, some of these people. And they said that they'd left the young men behind to look after the land, and they had become Al-Shabaab's new army because Al-Shabaab was feeding them and giving them a little bit of money. I mean, it sounds a bit radical, but in a way, the way to sort out this problem is actually to start paying people. You might even bribe people to leave Al-Shabaab, and then you might win over more people because it is a kind of financial issue.
I want to bring Mohammed in just a moment on that issue, but Mary, just briefly, when you say it's not black and white, it's all grey, do you think that Western governments get that but choose to ignore it? Or do you think that they are just blindly hoping that the path they're on will work?
I think that there are some very experienced, very sensitive people in administrations of all the countries that are now pouring into Somalia to kind of help sort out the security and see potential for their own profit in the end with investments. There are some people in Turkey, the Gulf, the West, etc., who understand this. But it's almost like they have to put that aside, because if that is the situation, if that's the reality, that is something that's too difficult for them with their rather simplistic way of trying to sort out the Somali problem, which is through a battle with Al-Shabaab. So it's almost if, even though they understand that might be the reality, they have to ignore it because they are now trying to pursue the military solution against Al-Shabaab, which does mean seeing it as a binary situation, which it absolutely isn't.
Mohammed, that issue that Mary raised about people essentially joining Al-Shabaab because that's the only way to get a paycheck. How important do you think dealing with that is when we're talking about the root of the problem with Al-Shabaab? Is it that actually for most people involved, it isn't necessarily about ideology, it's about either security or it's about getting food?
I think it's multi-layered. There's people who join because of ideology, and that's a very small minority, and they are the core members of the group, the people the group relies on for existence. Then there's the majority of the members, people who join for worldly reasons and they want to get a job, or they've been conscripted. I think something that's been overlooked and which is a major issue now just emerging is that Al-Shabaab is conscripting little children all across southern Somalia. It has created little madrasas where the clans have to pay running of the madrasas. Al-Shabaab runs the madrasas. When the children reach 15, they just take them to the battlefield without consulting their parents, which is very horrible. And we've seen many children who have defected recently and who have undergone that treatment. And it's really very common now. So there's people who will join Al-Shabaab to get fed, but I think others were forced. A very small percentage are joining because of ideology.
Mary, when we talk about what the international community can do in Somalia, we have in the past been talking about the US, UK, the European Union. But as you just mentioned, there are lots of other international players involved in Somalia now. Turkey has decided that it wants to play a big role there. Turkish Airlines opened a direct route between Istanbul and Mogadishu, had a shiny new embassy, invested a lot of money. The UAE has invested money as well. China, lots of other states in the Gulf are interested. How has that changed the dynamic inside Somalia?
It's really complicated, the situation. there was recently a big London conference on Somalia, the third one since 2012. And the so-called international community, which is basically the UN and the West, that's how you have to think of it. They're tearing their hair out because now they're saying we can't even formulate a plan for the security of Somalia anymore because we've got the UAE, Turkey, so many other countries training different bits of the Somali forces all over the country. We don't know what anyone else is doing. And in fact, when I flew to Mogadishu the last time, I was sitting next to two Turkish engineers. As we went into the city, all the way along the beach to the south is this enormous Turkish military base. And they told me they were building it. They said it's Turkey's biggest military base outside Turkey. And they said, you know, officially it's for training. And then they showed me, because they had all the plans with them, they showed me like the training center is tiny. What that is for, I do not know. You've got the UAE is now building a military base in Somaliland. So you've got not only these foreign powers coming in because they see investment opportunities, maybe they can get some kudos for helping this country that has been such a disaster for so long, but they are also seeing it as a key part of strategy. And we mustn't forget that now with the situation in Yemen, with the Saudi coalition, UAE, which is a key ally in that, they've already got a base in Eritrea, Assab. It looks like their military base in Somaliland will also be used as part of conducting a war in Yemen. So now I think it's better to think of the whole of the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Somalia, Somaliland, Djibouti, Eritrea. You have to think of it as part of a Red Sea zone that includes Gulf countries as well. It's a new geopolitical situation that is developing. And in some ways, Ethiopia is losing its regional authority. It really is threatened by all these new interests. And also the so-called international community, which is basically the West, is becoming far less powerful and influential because Somalia has so many other people to choose from. And places like the Qatar, UAE, Turkey, they're not so concerned about corruption. You know, they sort of see it as entirely normal to fly in a plane. Like in Mogadishu, there was one time I was there and the whole city shut down because Kuwait was flying in a plane filled with cash for vote buying during a previous election. It was just considered totally normal for Kuwait to do that, or Qatar, or these other countries who don't sort of have the same idea of clean democratic processes as there are in the West.
Mohammed, can any good come from other countries, aside from the normal Western donors, being involved in Somalia, or do you just see downsides?
I think all international foreign support to the Somali people and the Somali government, as long as it's not Somali-led and Somali-needs-driven, it's not productive. The current government and, to a less extent, the previous one, they've tried to make the process, the aid and the support and the an intervention by Somalia's partners to be Somali-needs-driven. So I think, in a sense, if that were to happen, it's good. But every country is coming here for its own interest. And the Somali government does not steer them towards its own interests, I think it will not be a very pretty end.
Mohammed, if we've been talking about the future of Somalia and the Somali state 10, 15 years ago, there might have been some discussions about how there are some inside Somalia who think of a greater Somalia, the five points of the stars, including Djibouti and the Ogaden and the Somali region of northern Kenya. And yet now when you talk about the structure of the country, it feels increasingly balkanized, doesn't it? That you don't just have Somaliland, which obviously declared itself independent, but there are other regions like Puntland, like Jubaland and others that feel as it almost feels as if the country is breaking apart.
I think there's a misunderstanding about what this Puntland and Jubaland and all this are. It's enshrined in the constitution. The Somali people agreed on having a federal system. It's not like Washington State and Texas are different countries. It's the same country with the different systems and coming under the federal government. It's the same here. On paper, it's not very problematic. But in practice, regional players have used the federal member states to their advantage, which was not properly addressed. And so I think that's the problem. But in principle, I don't think there's anything wrong with having a federal system. But you have Kenya supporting Jubaland for its own interests, and you have Ethiopia supporting Southwest Somalia and tried to heavily influence the recent elections and in support of the former president. So in that sense, it's very problematic.
I want to look forward to what we think might happen next. Mary, I'll begin with you. What are your hopes and fears about what the next 5-10 years can bring for Somalia, particularly in that new regional dynamic that you just described?
Yeah, I'll have to disagree with Mohamed on this one, because even though it might look on paper as one kind of solution to the Somali issue, it seems to me, like you said, this issue of balkanization, that is becoming a reality. For example, I did spend time in Southwest State. They are introducing a curriculum in the Mai language, which is a different dialect, a bit like Al-Shabaab now has its own curriculum as well. They hate the federal government. They hate federal troops. They're not supposed to have their own army, but they do, which is this force called the Darwish, who are very effective at fighting Al-Shabaab. They develop special relationships with Ethiopia, and the same in Jubaland. In a way, my kind of fear for Somalia is that this new federal structure, which was seen as this marvelous answer to Somali's perennial problem of the clan, might lead to another conflict developing. It's like every time Somalia has different complexions to its conflicts. It might be clan dynamics, it might be violent Islamist extremism. And I fear the third stage of this 30-year conflict is going to be one between the regions. And I'm afraid I do not feel hopeful about Somalia. I feel very hopeful about Somalis. They're fantastically dynamic people. They are incredibly brave. They're like the world's most globalized, most expert connected community like that. But the actual territory, I don't feel that it's going to be stable or safe, probably in my lifetime.
Mohamed, are you as pessimistic as Mary?
I think the results would have been much different if the last 5 years were not squandered. So I look optimistically towards the next 4 years, and we'll know if it's going to be status quo very soon. So if it is, I might be as pessimistic as she is.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Mohamed Mubarak and Mary Harper, thank you both very much for joining us on The Foreign Desk. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of The Foreign Desk. Next week, in the second part of this series, we'll be discussing Ethiopia. I do hope you can join us. The Foreign Desk is produced by Bill Luti and Carlotta Ribello, researched by Hunter Charlton, and edited by Cassie Galpin. My name is Steve Bloomfield. That was The Foreign Desk. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.